Thank God it's Free Range. You are listening to Free Range Radio Friday with your host, Michael Elves. Pour yourself a beverage and turn up the volume, because here on 101.5 UMFM, the weekend starts now.
UMFM. This is Thank God It's Free Range, the Friday edition of Free Range Radio. I'm Michael Elves, and kicking things off for us tonight, that's new soul singer Olivia Nelson with the Paul Mond remix of Never Too Late from the upcoming EP For You. We've got a great show for you tonight. We're going to be hearing the latest Go to the Gig edition of Ticket Monster's selections. This one a spooky version, apparently. We're also going to be talking to novelist Helen Humphreys about her latest novel, Machine Without Horses. And we got all sorts of great new music, including this brand new single from the posthumous release Black Velvet by the Screaming Eagle of Soul, Charles Bradley. This is Can't Fight the Feeling here on 101.5 UMFM. Oh!
Can't fight the feeling, baby. favorite authority on popular music.
Whoa! Ticket Momster, good!
But Boris, she does not dig the Transylvania twist.
That's awesome! Thank you to my friend Jerry for creating that for me. Oh my gosh, that's so cool, I love it. And I don't know what happened to the Transylvania twist, but we're gonna play it at the end of this segment. I do dig it, don't worry about it, it's okay. Okay, so I have two shows to recommend. This is my Halloween edition. Ooh! And the first show I wanted to recommend for next week is on Halloween. It's at the Westin Cultural Center, and it's A Nightmare on Ellis Street with Atlas and Vikings. Tickets are at ticketfly.com. It sounds really cool. And the second show that I wanted to recommend is on October 28th. That's the Sunday. It's Todd Barton's Halloween. It's the Winnipeg premiere of Gruber's Frankenstein. And I don't really know a lot about this show, so I just went on iTunes and I looked it up, and there's one little song. I guess this is an orchestra arrangement. Arrangement for orchestras. And there's one little song called Batman and Robin. It's like 30 seconds long. So let's listen to this and just see like if we can get like a feel of what this is going to be like. Here we go. Gruber's Frankenstein, Batman and Robin.
Batman and Robin still lie in their bed. Robin's a nice boy, but Batman's ill-bred. Batman to tie and Robin to two. Coffee's on and it's breakfast at home.
What in the world? Oh my goodness. Okay, all right, look, I'm still recommending this show. And I'll tell you why. This is part of Jazz Winnipeg's New Sound series. Just like the Winnipeg Symphony Orchestra's New Music Festival, it's all like unconventional, like not your typical mainstream run-of-the-mill kind of stuff. This is like out-of-the-box kind of stuff. In my experience, there's two roads that these shows can take. One, actually there's three. One, the first one is that you'll be like, what is going on here? I love this. It's incredible. And it can be like the best show of the year. Second, it can be like, I don't really get this, but it's fine. And the third is that it can go down in flames. So let's hope it's not the third or the second. Let's hope this is like the best show of the year. Because it's just, I think it's going to be really interesting. And so, and I love Todd Martin. I think he's a fantastic musician, Winnipeg musician, and I like his Dirty Catfish Brass Band stuff, so there's no reason why I shouldn't like this. Oh, for the love of God, please, I hope it's great. So let's go find out. Tickets are at ticketfly.com. It's this Sunday, October 28th. And yeah, let's just see what happens. If you can't make it, head over to my Facebook page at Ticket Momster, and I'll have the story written up shortly after the show, and you can read all about it there. By the way, did I mention that this show is at the Goodwill Social Club? Which is really interesting because it's a tiny little stage, but this is an orchestra arrangement, and there's going to be like 15 musicians on stage. I don't know how they're going to fit all of them on there, but it should be interesting. Okay, let's switch gears here. This is my Halloween segment, so I feel like I need to play some of my favorite Halloween songs. Now, my most favorite Halloween song is Monster Mash, and I know that it's like the most popular Halloween song, so I'm not going to play it because maybe you're sick of it by now, and I can just played 800 times at home anyway, so that's totally fine. So instead, I'm going to play a Bo Diddley tune, Bo Meets the Monster, and I'm going to follow that up with Virgil Holmes' Ghost Train, and we're going to end it with the Transylvania Twist, like I promised. As always, if you would like to read more about the shows that I'm recommending, you can go to my Facebook page at Ticket Momster, and there's also a whole bunch of stories there of past shows that I've seen and stories that I've written about them. So anyway, have a great Halloween, have fun, stay safe, and we'll see you next week. Enjoy the tunes. Bye.
Thank you. sitting in my front room, I heard a loud clang. I run to the window to see what was that. Out in the top of my old apple tree, there was one of purple people here looking at me. Jumped in my plane and I took to the cloud. I had to go see what the mess was all about. Oh, this mess my mother did not understand. All these funny looking people from another land. I said, lock all the windows and bolt all the doors. See how, boy, you ought to see. He was a wiggling and a grinning and a sniggling at me. I jumped in my plane and I made it back home. The purple people eat up at my baby and gone.
Transylvania twist. Good.
You see, even Frankie likes it.
What will the living dig it?
Of course, stupid. It's a rocker.
Thank you. pumpkin. So talented, how you cut the pumpkins. One of a smile, next one a short it. Anything that you want, trick or treat. But them can't get with this Halloween. This love, love, and them can't intake. Color, we got two pumpkins. One a king, one a queen.
Do you wanna cut pumpkins? Have a happy little Halloween. Do you wanna cut pumpkins with me? I wanna know now.
We're back here on Thank God It's Free Range. Right before the break, you heard The Hooks from Thom Yorke's version of Suspiria, music for the Luca Guadagnino film. That just landed in my lap this week from XL Recordings. Before that, Carve Pumpkins. It is the season, and that is a new reggae act. And before that, the Phonosonics out of Vancouver with Wingardium Leviosa, a Harry Potter ska tribute track. We're going to move away from the Halloween stuff, and in fact, we're going to move away from music entirely in just a couple minutes. We're going to be talking to Helen Humphreys, author of Machine Without Horses. But before we get to that, it is the release day for Makaya McRaven's Universal Beings. This is the second album for the Chicago jazz artist this year, out on International Anthem Records. It comes out today. I am very excited that it's out. It is a fantastic record, and I'm going to play you one of my favorite tracks, Mantra, here on 101.5 UMFM. Well, her latest novel is called Machine Without Horses. It's out through HarperCollins. Helen Humphreys joins us on the line. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Lots of questions about this book, that's for sure.
Okay.
I guess I'm going to start with you in the acknowledgements thank Anne Hardcastle for leading you to your subject. And I'm curious what that process was like. What did Anne do to bring this to your attention?
She gave me the obituary from the New York Times for Megan Boyd. that was a very quite a lengthy obituary and gave her sort of overview of her story and first got me interested in considering writing about her.
Did she give it to you with the intent of being like, this is a character you might be interested in as a person, or just randomly gave it to you?
Yes, she gave it to me with the idea that this might be somebody I'd be interested in writing about because she found her interesting. And in the beginning, Anne was an actor, and in the beginning we thought we might do something together. I would write something for her to act in a more of a play form, but then we just got busy with other things.
Oh, with an eye to making like a Megan Boyd play.
Yeah, but that was, I don't know, a while ago when I first had the obituary, like 10 years ago maybe.
Right.
And then we just got busy with other things, and so I just, you know, I had it piled away in a bunch of papers and then rediscovered it a few years ago and decided it would be a, you know, good novel and sort of started there.
Right. So this novel, I mean, essentially there's kind of two halves to this novel. There's a process story and then sort of a more literary story in the second half. I'm curious about the decision making that went into writing it this way.
Well, I decided, I don't know, I guess, when you start any kind of creative work, there's always a confluence of things around the work just from your own life that are happening, right? And I had just been, I don't know what it was, but I guess it was this idea that I, at this age and stage of my life and my career, I felt that it would be good to just talk about how one writes a novel. It's, when I teach, it's the thing people want to know. Mm-hmm. They want to know what the process is. And a lot of writers, you know, talk about it as being a mysterious thing that involves the muse or whatever, but I'm not one of those writers that ascribes to that. And so I thought, why not just be transparent with the whole thing and just make the book, in a way, a primer for how to write a novel. So the first half is showing the process, and the second half is the, you know, the small novel, as it is, that utilizes the process.
Right. Is this one of those, like, show, don't tell kind of circumstances when it comes to teaching then? Like, is it, you know, let me lay it bare for you by like, going through the mechanics of it?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, if anybody wants, I've written, it's my eighth novel, so I know a few things about novels mm-hmm. by now. And so this is sort of what I know about writing a novel. It's like, it's every novelist, of course, has a different way of working, but it's how I work. And so if people are interested in seeing how I work, then there it is, right, out there.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, with any book, there's drafts and revisions and things get excised and stuff like that. I'm curious about sort of that first half of the book that goes through the process of writing a book. What did or didn't kind of make the cut? Like, was there anything that you initially included as far as process that for the purpose of kind of paring down and getting at the core of this, you had to eliminate? Or
no, it's pretty much as it is. I didn't really... I do a lot of thinking before I write and make note taking and things. So sometimes when I write, it's pretty clean because I've sort of worked all that stuff out beforehand. So, it's pretty much, I don't think I excised or anything in that first part or added anything even.
Right.
I did in the second part, not excise, but added a few things.
Can I ask then, I mean, I wanted to get to the second part later, but what did get added in that second half that wasn't in the initial draft?
Just a chapter, I think in, I can't remember which one it was, of Megan's early life that I skipped. There was a kind of a gap in the chronology, and so I added in something more in her early life that fleshed it out better.
Right. Now, the book takes its title from a dance, Machine Without Horses, that kind of mimics a train. And I'm curious because there was a lot of, as far as, I mean, reading the book, there could be a number of titles for this book. What was it about that dance and about that name of that dance that made you want to make it the title?
Well, I needed a title that applied equally to both halves of the book. And so I thought that title, it makes sense in terms of the first half because it was a dance that Megan Boyd did and enjoyed doing and was good at. And then in terms of the second half, I like that a description as to what a novel is. You know, a novel is kind of it's a machine. If it's working well, it's kind of a machine that's moving under its own energy. So I thought Machine Without Horses was kind of a nice way to describe a novel as well.
Right.
So that's why it's there.
Had there been any consideration of other titles, or was it kind of just apparent when you thought about it?
Nope, that's the title I thought of pretty early on. Actually, I just described it backwards. The second half is the one where it features, and then the first part is the making of a novel. I had that. You know, with titles for me, either come right away or I labor over them later. But this one, it sort of came right away. So
right,
I knew I wanted to do that.
You mentioned kind of like the mechanics laid bare of the first half in terms of the writing of a novel, but there's a lot of philosophical questions that the author in that first half poses, and I have to imagine it's you, right?
Yes, it's a loosely based version of me, although some things are made up in there, but not much.
But I suppose the questions that you pose to yourself as an author are the questions that you yourself pose when approaching a book then?
Yep, that's right.
Because one of the ones I flagged was that, you write, most stories have been told before. Most themes have been touched upon, so it matters how you choose to tell a story. And it pays to spend a lot of time trying to figure out what the optimum way to do this is going to be. So in the case of Machine Without Horses, was there a lot of time spent with the consideration of this, like, cleaved two halves that needed to be married, or what was the consideration in terms of how to tell the story in this case?
Yeah, well, I had to, think around it a lot. So I did initially think of doing it just as one thing, just as the story. But, I was also thinking about just about my own career as a writer and just teaching and writing, and just all these other things were happening at the same time, which is why I thought up the idea of showing the process. So I do a lot of lateral thinking around a novel, and I just try and think of all the different ways in which I could tell it. And the thing with that story is it's a pretty quiet story.
Mm-hmm.
It's a pretty quiet, even though she was a famous person, she had a kind of quiet life. So how do you get at the quiet life and make it interesting for the reader? So that was my big thing I had to think about, I guess, is how to do that. And so this seemed like a good solution.
Right. Now, what are the other things that you raise within that first half is around the random nature of real life versus, fiction? There has to be sort of a through line or like a narrative build to it. And so, in the first half, you talk about, a man walking his dog and then he can be dead. But you say, as far as, approaching that second half of the story, that the writer needs to build it as though they were making a machine, with each cog in place, with each part in place. When you're fictionalizing a real life, though, like, what goes into the mechanics of that? And do you feel this is kind of like somehow a bridge between the two?
Yeah, the first part is of that book is all about imagining. I there were certain facts of the real life that I had to go on.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was a lot of imagining that had to take place between those facts of what, what the life could be like. And it's one way of looking at it. Somebody else would have looked at it a different way. But everything has to be hold water. Everything has to be able to stand up under scrutiny. So it all has to make a certain kind of sense. It has to be logical. It has to arise out of the facts of things that are known. It has to make sense, right? I can't have things that are kind of wildly divergent, or you lose, the reader won't believe in it, and they won't read it. It's kind of it's a puzzle, right? And it's a way you're trying to solve the puzzle and make it make sense.
Is it a puzzle in this case where some of the pieces are blank, that because you only have so much biographical information about Megan and about like sort of the chronology of her life, that you then have to figure out which pieces are missing and how to color those in?
Yeah, well, I'm not writing a biography. I mean, if I was writing a biography, I would have to do it somewhat differently, but I'm writing a novel, so I can invent in those spaces, right? I don't have to not everything has to be fact, but the facts that I have and the what I invent to attach those facts together has to make a certain kind of sense in light of the facts, right? So, but I am making a piece of fiction, so it's not a biography.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just meant like it has to hew to some sort of like actual things. Like she's not suddenly like fighting, you know, behind the lines in France during the war or something.
Exactly.
Like she has to be where she was.
Yeah, that's right. And the facts of her life can't be ignored, but the spaces can be filled in.
Right. So then in filling those spaces, obviously that's where you have the creative control and the liberty. Is there like any sort of internal pressure about how you build that life and infill like that as a creator, or is that a very freeing thing to have that opportunity?
I don't know. There's responsibility involved, but there also has to be, you know, to make the story work, there has to be a kind of energy to it. And to get that kind of energy, you can't be too controlling of the process, or it just sort of squashes it. So it's, I don't know. It's just a certain amount of letting myself just go in a certain direction that feels like the right direction to go in. Just trusting, and then also, being responsible in terms of the facts and the order of things and that, you know, that sort of stuff. So it's just a dance, I suppose, between that,
mm-hmm.
between sort of a kind of freedom and a kind of control.
You mentioned that being a dance, and obviously the title itself takes it from a dance. There's a lot of motion for a fairly still novel. Is that like, how do you kind of convey that or bake that in into something where, you know, I mean, this is a woman who sat in her shed making lures in a pretty like still manner for most of her life, and yet you need to build in some movement to this. How do you go about doing that?
Yeah, I had one of the things I had to figure out was how to make the story interesting enough for people to read it, and so to build some tension in to have a fast paced story. And the way to sort of the chronology is very compressed. The events are very compressed, even though there aren't that many of them. And then I also did purposely make a lot of movement within the story. So she's rushing around. There's a lot of kind of the dancing, there's fishing, there's the, she races around on a motorcycle, so that there's a lot of, so that it puts movement and energy into the narrative and gives it a kind of tension to move it forward.
The other tension that you introduce is this love story. And at one point in the book, the author says, "I wonder if a lover needs to be the solution to the problem that each person represents, an antidote to them." As a creator, then, is that lover that you create the antidote for the narrative problem in the book, in some sense?
I think the lover is the kind of antidote to the character, that's based on Megan.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think it doesn't go much further than that. I think it's just on that personal level. I think that it works that way. I mean, the way that all of us are locked into our kind of patterns or awkwardness or whatever that we have, and sometimes people can come along that love us, that can liberate us from ourselves in that way. And I think that's what I wanted between those two, between the lover and the Megan character, was to have that kind of sense of liberation.
So do you enter into that with the hopes of creating that liberation and then figure out how to write it so that it is liberating for Megan? Or did you start writing it and then realize this represents some sort of liberation for Megan?
No, I think about it first and just try and sort of think of what sort of person would be attracted to on one hand to that character, and then what sort of person would that character would be a kind of helpful person to that character in terms of freeing themselves from some of their, I don't know, more some of their patterns, I guess, that aren't necessarily helping them, or that's kind of the wrong word, but you know, people just get locked into themselves. And I think when somebody like that character sits in that shed and just does the same thing hour after hour, day after day, month after month, year after year, they're kind of locked in a sort of prison. And so I was thinking of the lover as being someone that could liberate them from that prison, and what kind of person would be able to do that. So I thought about it beforehand.
Right. So
most everything I think about beforehand, and then in the writing of it, there's some freedom in the writing of it, but it's a small but tight story, so everything sort of has to be figured out beforehand.
And I have to imagine you have to figure out kind of the economy of things if it's going to be a tight, small story then.
Yeah.
You have to have that planned out in advance.
Yeah.
So, Megan, one of the things you kind of point out is sort of the inherent strangeness to Megan's avocation, and the fact that, you know, she makes these lures for fishermen, but she herself, you know, doesn't fish. She doesn't ever think about kind of the end consequence of these salmon being fished out of the river necessarily. And there's like kind of an incongruous nature to her life's pursuit. Was that something that you were like mulling over on a philosophical level as you were researching Megan and then writing her?
Well, I just found it was one of the things that attracted me to the story in the first place, because it's really interesting. It's an interesting thing, this idea that how do you get to be the best at something that you haven't tried yourself? So that's kind of a mystery in a way. And it's one of the things that really attracted me to writing about her. So I thought about it a lot. And, you know, what was she doing if she wasn't making these, you know, what if she wasn't, if she wasn't making something to kill the fish, then what was she doing, you know? And that was an interesting thing to ponder.
As an author, was it something of interest just from the fact that, like, not every character that you write is something that you've lived or, you know, that you yourself would do, that in some ways Megan's approach might mirror that of an author?
I didn't really think of it that way. I did just think of it as being attached to her and what sort of person she would be that would, you know, what was it, what was she doing it for? I guess I thought about that a lot.
The motivation.
Yeah, the motivation for doing that. It's hard work and it's picky, and it eventually made her blind. So it's there has to be a lot of reward in it. And if you fished, you could see the immediate reward would be being part of that community and making something that you yourself would use. But if you don't fish, then you're doing it for some other reason. So.
Right. Now,
so I didn't think of it in terms of writing it, really, even though making a lure is similar to making a novel, but I didn't think of, it didn't really go past that for me.
Right, that there might be some parallel with you as the lure maker and then the reader as the fisher person.
Yeah.
In the first half, the writer goes and learns how to make lures. Is that something you did yourself?
I did do that, yeah. I did do that myself. And I learned, I took some lessons. I don't think I really was very good at much, but I did get pretty good at a fly called the woolly bugger, which is not a salmon fly, but I did take lessons, yeah, so I could know what it was like and what it felt like and the process.
Is that something you've done with previous novels to kind of figure out process of a character?
Yep, I usually do some kind of method thing with the novels. It makes it easier to understand what's happening for them, to make it realistic.
And that's part of that, like, mechanical or lateral thinking that you described as far as, you know, prepping for the writing?
Yeah, it's part of my research. Yeah.
In doing that, then, you do write about the person who teaches you to tie the lures, and they have sort of a backstory. Is that invented wholly, or is that something that...
That's wholly invented. That character's wholly invented.
Okay. So I was curious about the decision to do that. Like, that there's clearly stuff drawn from reality, but, you know, fictionalized in that sense. Giving that lure instructor this backstory that you do, was there a specific kind of motivating factor or idea behind that?
No, I just wanted him to have some connection. You know, I didn't want to write about the real... I felt it was a breach of privacy to write about the real person I'd taken lessons from, so I invented someone. But I gave him a backstory that would fit in with the kind of author character. They'd have some points of connection there. So I did it for that reason. You know, it was intentional.
Right. So I guess the like fundamental sort of philosophical thing is around like solitary pursuits. You know, the author is a solitary pursuer. Megan herself is a solitary pursuer, and there's a lot of kind of like internal activity, you know, whether she's thinking about, you know, the lure she's tying, or the author is thinking about the story that she's telling. Coming away from this book and looking back on it now as an author, like, is there something that you see about yourself as an author that you didn't know or understand going into the writing of this book?
I don't think so. I think part of writing in that book is thinking about those things out loud in a that kind of public forum. So stuff that I would just ordinarily think of to myself, I'm writing down, but it doesn't mean I haven't thought of it before. You know, it's I've written for a long time now, and I've written a lot of books now, so I think a lot about writing and being a writer, and at this point in my life, being a writer. So there aren't too many more. I don't know. There aren't too many more things to learn about myself in that regard, I think. Although there's always more to learn about the story I'm writing or what I'm pursuing. But I think I don't think I learned anything as just exposed what I was already thinking, I guess.
Laid it bare.
Yeah.
Now, you mentioned that Anne Hardcastle gave you Megan's obituary about 10 years ago, and then you kind of rediscovered it. Is that sort of a normal thing for you to kind of have a pile of notes or possible inspirations for stories and then to go back to them? Like, going forward on the next novel, is that exploring something from the past, or is it wholly fresh and new when you kind of finish off a previous novel?
Yeah, funnily enough, the next book is something from the past also, weirdly enough. Something I actually worked on about 10 years, 12 years ago maybe. I don't know, but anyway, but had put aside also for different reasons. So I usually don't go back. I usually things come from something out, but they can come from anything, some idea or something I've seen or just some small observation. But it's usually not a backwards thing. But in this, it's funny that in this book and in the one I'm working on now, it is something that's from the past.
Right. Well, the current book is Machine Without Horses. It's out through HarperCollins. Helen Humphreys, thanks very much for taking some time to talk about it.
Thank you very much.
Say what you want, I've always been honest enough. Say what you want, I've tried to be myself in love. Yes, I found another man and he gave me what you couldn't. It's tough. See, I couldn't close the door and say no to something more. It's rough. To have the heart of a man who loves free, invites golden bruises, heart
you want, you read the label on the package. Yourself wanna love me and love me, not a product you can purchase. Angel, yes, I found another man and he gave me what you couldn't. It's hell. See, I couldn't close the door and say you noticed something more.
We are back here on Thank God It's Free Range. You just heard a new one from Anchor Song, their album Cohesion, about to drop on True Thoughts. We heard Mindscape. Before that, LA funk act The Night Show with Mr. Mojo, the lead off to their self-titled four-song EP. And we started this set off with Eklo and Heart of a Man from Eklo Location. Going to switch it up a little bit. Going to move into some rock and folk stuff. Folly and the Hunter kind of bridging both of those genres. Their new album is called The Remains. We're going to hear a track called The Line. And then a brand new single from Winnipeg's own Living Hour called Bottom Step that just dropped today out on Bandcamp. And then something that's not even out from our pal Royce Berth. He's got a new track called Belong. And we're going to cap things off with the Cold Manitoba Project and their titular song, Cold Manitoba. Hopefully you have a great weekend. Stick around for After 8 Radio. We'll be back next week.
Storm and forward. reasons that you know. Tell me, should I stay? Tell me, should I go? Loving that so strange, it feels unknown. Oh, so alone. I may not come back feeling all the same. But something's in me telling me you change. And by the time you get here, I'll make straight. Searching for a place I could be alone. I'm searching for a place I could be alone. I'm searching for a place I could be alone. I'm searching for a place I could be alone. I heard things that you told me in the past. Is here today and never lasts. Only what I know now has come to pass. Oh, so fast. Child's play, not so simple growing up. I'm just looking for loving places. Seeing familiar faces, yeah, yeah, yeah. How fast comes to a close. I'm searching for a place I could be alone. I'm searching for a place I could be alone. I'm searching for a place I could be alone. I'm searching for a place I could be alone. You ain't gotta worry about a thing. Cause everything's gonna be alright. All you gotta do is hold on, hold on, yeah, hey, yeah, yes. I'm searching for a place I could be alone. Searching for a place I could be alone. I'm searching for a place I could be alone. I'm searching for a place I could be alone. I'm searching for a place I could be alone. I don't care about the 1%. And I don't care about the money you spend. And I don't care where you come from. Just know you got a place where you can be alone. And I don't care about your skin. And I don't care about your age. And I don't care about the race. Just know you got place.
Cold Manitoba, what have you done to the sky, to the sky, to the sky.